This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. A timely podcast on the subject of the coronavirus, which is causing so much consternation and havoc. This is a day that, when we recorded this podcast, that is marked by essentially lockdowns in the state of California and here in New York City, where I'm broadcasting from. And I recently returned from an international trip to Tortola, which is in the British Virgin Islands. Not a single case down there, but a little bit daunting to get on planes and go through airports where people are wearing scary-looking masks and a lot of hand-washing and have made it safely here into what is essentially the hot zone, New York City. Lots of cases here, 5,000 so far. With us today, Dr. Leo Galland. Dr. Galland is one of my favorite guests here on Intelligent Medicine. He's been a frequent contributor here, and he's well-respected in the integrative community. He's a veteran MD who practices in New York City, trained here at NYU and Bellevue, and he's received all kinds of accolades for his breakthroughs and innovations in understanding how we can apply natural therapies to various health problems. He's really been a mentor to me over many years. I've learned a lot from him, and he's got a lot to share with us on the subject because he's been doing a deep dive on coronavirus, a very, very thorough review of the scientific literature on what works and what doesn't, and what does it mean. So without further ado, Leo, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, it's always great to be talking with you, Ron, and I am excited to talk about this because this is, we're really looking at a very perilous situation. And I just want to preface everything that I'm going to say by stating that I never intended to go public with information or advice about COVID-19. But a couple of months ago, it became clear to me that this was something that was going to really be troubling my patients, and I wanted to be able to answer their questions. In the past, I had worked out a protocol for preventing flu or protecting yourself from flu during the winter, which was all based with natural products, all based on randomized controlled clinical trials, very solid data. I put that together for my patients. I knew there wouldn't be anything like that for coronavirus, but I wanted to make sure that I understood what the possibilities were.
And you know, I just want to mention that there's a bit of a danger in extrapolating, because we can say, oh, you know, these are all these wonderful things that we know about for supporting immunity, things that have been used traditionally in traditional cultures for respiratory problems. But this is a unique and new problem, and we really have to approach this with a very skeptical mind when it comes to application of some of the tried and true nutraceuticals and vitamins and supplements that we might have used in the past, correct?
Right, absolutely. Coronavirus is not flu. It's not even the same as SARS, and although that's a close relative. it is unique. It has unique properties that are being discovered almost on a daily basis. And the whole approach to treatment is just a moving target, and it's constantly unfolding. And there are some exciting discoveries. So the first, and of course, the first thing that I wanted to look at was, what do you do not to get infected? None of the natural products, I think, are capable of keeping you from getting infected. Their goal is to help you become less sick if you're infected. And the fact is that this virus, is the way it's going, is just going to sweep through the country. That's one of the reasons why I had offered to speak on this podcast. The data do not really reveal how deep the threat is. But I'll just give you the perspective that I have, which is a straightforward mathematical perspective. We don't know how many cases there are, because most patients are not tested, and it's still very hard to get testing in New York.
And the one theory, Leo, is that some of the people who may have experienced a bad, what they thought was a flu, say in, last month, they had a cough, a shortness of breath, a fever, and they said, man, I'm a 4+ sick, this is unusual. Is it conceivable that some of them may have had coronavirus even then?
Sure. And I'll explain why when I just go through the math.
Sure.
So what I think is pretty certain is that the death rate, what's called the case fatality rate, is about 1%. That's what Anthony Fauci of the NIH says. And I base my support for that on the experience of the Diamond Princess cruise ship, because there everybody, all 3,500 people on the ship, were tested. So the idea that, well, maybe you got a high rate because you weren't testing all the positives, that doesn't apply.
The so-called numerator and denominator problem. In other words, the people that we're seeing, coming up positive, well, they're coming to the attention of the health authorities. They're being allowed to get tested. A lot of people can't even get tested, or they just have mild cases. They stay at home and they're just not noted.
Right. So on that ship, there were 706 people who tested positive. Six of them died. That's a case fatality rate of 0.85%. Almost 1%, and that's a group that is ambulatory and well-fed. So if you look at the general population, where there are people who are really disabled or homeless, in nursing homes, it's going to be a much higher rate. Mm-hmm. Homeless shelters, it's going to be a much higher rate. I think 1% as a case fatality rate is very reasonable. That means that if you know how many people have died, and I don't know what the number is right now, 200 today in the U.S., that is 1% of the population of people with the virus. That is, however, it's not 1% of the population of people who have the virus now. It's 1% of the people who had the virus 3 or 4 weeks ago, because people don't die immediately. It takes about 3 weeks for them to get to the hospital, another few days for them to die, which means that a month ago, when there were only a few hundred cases being reported in the U.S., there were probably already 20,000 cases of COVID-19 infection in the U.S. The other thing that we know is that the death rate doubles every 3 days. So if you apply that math, that means if we go back 30 days and then we take 10 doubling times, we're now up to probably, instead of 200 people, they're probably 200, 300,000 people with COVID-19 infection in the U.S. And if this continues and is not checked, within another 6 weeks, virtually everyone in the country could be infected, and there could be 3 million deaths. So that's what we're really looking at. It is not the present situation. It's what we are heading into. We are on the edge of a volcanic crater.
Yeah, so I cracked the history books and I looked at, you know, what is a historical antecedent, which is the Spanish flu. Spanish flu killed 3 to 5% of the world's population. In the United States, there weren't 3 million deaths, but there were 675,000 deaths. That amounts to around 0.5% of the population of the United States. But worldwide, there were 50 to 100 million deaths. It's hard to estimate because the record keeping was so poor. In the U.S., 28% of the population contracted it. But what's interesting is that it was a very different virus. About over 90% of the deaths, according to some sources, 99% of the cases of the deaths were under 65. So it actually affected people in a different pattern.
Right.
Half the deaths in young adults, 20 to 40 years of age.
Yeah, that was a virus that really seemed to hit young adults. Now, the thing is, although it has been said in the studies from China that young adults didn't seem to get very sick with it, a recent study from the CDC in the U.S. is that the rate of hospitalization among people aged 20 to 44 is actually greater than among middle-aged adults and older middle-aged adults. I mentioned that to my son. He said it's because everybody's vaping.
That's a good point.
You know, and that may be. That may be, and maybe they're not doing that in China.
Well, they're living in an environment where every day when you breathe the air in Beijing, Shanghai, Wuhan,
yeah,
it's equivalent
right.
to vaping. You know, it's air pollution, and then they smoke a lot. They smoke a lot of cigarettes,
right.
Face it.
Yes. Well, at any rate, there is this feature among young people in the U.S. that hasn't been reported elsewhere, or in China, as yet. I think it was reported in Italy. Now, the other thing about it is not just the mortality rate from the virus itself, it's what it's doing to our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've heard from people in Seattle that the healthcare system there is totally overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lack of equipment and supplies. Health professionals are getting only 2 hours sleep a night. Some of them are getting sick and dying. We're heading into that similar situation in New York. And people who are very sick with other conditions unrelated to COVID-19 are not able to get the care that they need.
Mm-hmm. And that would be sort of collateral damage of the virus.
Yeah. So the collateral damage might even wind up being greater than the direct damage of the virus itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, isn't there something to this notion, and I've read some articles, that natural immunity confers some protection. So, yes, okay, you know, if you're immunosuppressed, if you're a smoker, if you're on an immunosuppressive medication and, you know, for organ transplants or for rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis, now even for psoriasis, arthritis, and there's so many Americans who are on these medications. If you're obese, diabetic, cardiovascular disease, and Americans, you know, this has been the whole basis of our practice over the years. Americans are very sick. The terrain on which the virus can act is very vulnerable terrain, right?
Right. And that is related to the first observation that I made about this virus. And actually, the group at greatest risk appears to be people with high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And the studies from Australia and China found that 30% of the people were hypertensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that, and reading about the biology of the virus that led me into my recognition that the viral receptor on cells is critically important, not just to the entry of the virus into the cell, and you're getting infected, but to the outcome of infection.
Mm-hmm. And that's been borne out by some of the research lately, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, there's some controversy about what these findings mean, and a lot of the data really goes back to SARS, which uses the same gateway to get into cells. And that gateway is a protein called ACE2, which stands for angiotensin converting enzyme 2. ACE2 is very prominent in the cardiovascular system. Cardiologists know about it a lot. It actually is an enzyme that improves circulation and blood flow, has anti-inflammatory effects, tissue healing effects. It's important in the kidneys. It exists in the lungs, in the periphery of the lung, in the air sacs, not in the bronchial tubes. But it's exactly the air sacs which is where the pneumonia from COVID-19 occurs. So it looks very different from the kind of pneumonia that people get after the flu, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a kind of characteristic appearance, say, on a CAT scan. Now, when...
Which, by the way, is thought to be one of the best diagnostic methods for diagnosing this, short of, obviously, the RNA PCR confirmation.
Right. If you can't do a swab and you're coughing and short of breath, chest X-ray or CAT scan.
And the Chinese are ramping that up to, you know, the enormous volume. You know, somehow they're pushing like 200 patients through a CAT scan every day.
Yeah, it's important. A couple of other things about the testing. This virus stays alive for some time after people get better, and it is shed in bowel movements. Mm-hmm. And Chinese studies have shown that even after the respiratory secretions become negative, stool still tests positive. So there is an opportunity for spread through food and water as well. That hasn't been documented yet. But it means that the period of quarantine really needs to be not just a few days or 2 weeks. A month is needed.
Wow.
Probably. Now, getting back to this ACE2. So my first thoughts when I read this were, well, you know, what about blocking ACE2 so the virus can't attach to it?
Mm-hmm. We have these drugs. I mean, they're commonly used for hypertension. ACE
inhibitors.
They're
not used. We don't have any drugs to block that. And then I realized that, well, ACE2 is really important. You don't want to block ACE2.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what a lot of the research showed was that the damage occurred because the virus inactivated H2, the enzyme activity of ACE2,
mm-hmm.
or in the words of one scientist, exhausted ACE2.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed to me that what would be important would be to enhance the stability and resilience of ACE2. And as I looked into it further, and looked at the mortality curve, how children and infants and children and in particular don't get very sick at all. And the older you get, the sicker you get. And looked at studies done in animals. ACE2 actually is much higher in young animals than in older animals. And so if there's better activity, there's more resilience, then as you get, then you're more likely to not be adversely affected.
Mm-hmm.
Or less adverse.
In other words, it won't be like a perfect shield, you know, impermeable barrier against the virus, but it will attenuate its effects if you get it.
Right. And after which, hopefully, you'll be immune. We haven't yet demonstrated whether there's individual immunity develops.
Mm-hmm.
Although an Australian study recently indicated that people who did better developed antibodies. So maybe there is hope for.
There's actually some talk of using convalescent sera as a way. In other words, very old-fashioned
way of
treating infections is to take the blood of healed people, purify it, and it's kind of like gamma globulin treatment, but specifically the sera of the recovered individuals transfers immunity to the yeah.
If that's all you have, and you have someone who's sick, it's something to consider. But at this point, that's not readily available.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question that I raised is, okay, well, is there a way to improve the resilience of ACE2? What are the factors that are associated with enhanced ACE2 activity?
So there's no drugs.
Right, yeah, no. Well, there are drugs that increase ACE2 activity, and the strongest of these are a class of drugs for high blood pressure called angiotensin receptor blockers, mm-hmm. or ARBs.
Commonly used, yeah.
Which are pretty widely used. And there actually is a study, an NIH study that's just starting, looking at the impact of losartan,
mm-hmm.
on, which is one of the one of those drugs, on COVID-19 infection. On the other hand, there are other researchers who have warned against that and said, well, that really increases the number of ACE2 molecules, and so maybe more of the virus gets into the cell, and maybe that's bad, and a lot of alarm spread on the internet,
right.
both about the ARBs and the ACE2 inhibitors. Studies in animals with the SARS virus showed that if you actually can administer a recombinant form of ACE2 to these animals, their lungs start to heal faster.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the mechanisms aren't totally
right.
clear.
So, but the take-home message for people who are on high blood pressure medication is not to, like, get the hell off your meds.
No.
Conversely, if you don't have high blood pressure, take a losartan. We're not there yet.
We're not there as to whether the ARBs would be protective or not.
Okay.
They actually might be, but we don't know. In the studies in which people with high blood pressure were shown to have an increased mortality rate, nobody looked at what meds these people were taking. And conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, coronary disease, the ones that are most often identified as being risk factors for being worse with coronavirus infection, those are all conditions associated with low baseline ACE2 activity.
Mm-hmm. But also a low general well-being, a high level of relative inflammation, obesity,
right.
blood sugar
right.
dysregulation that may not even be properly diagnosed, et cetera.
Right. So that then leads into the issue of innate immune function. There were two other aspects of the virus that I looked at, but I think it's important, since you brought it up, to talk about innate immunity and viral infections, because, again, there's a lot of controversy and a fair amount of misinformation that's circulating on the internet about this. So innate immunity protects against viral infections and is important in preventing the acquisition and early stages of COVID-19 infection. Once the infection becomes really established,
mm-hmm.
and there's pneumonia, a lot of the damage is associated with an overactive immune response.
And that's the theory behind the Spanish flu mortality, is that young,
right.
healthy individuals who had more robust immune systems, once their immune systems were turned onto hyperdrive, they turned against them and caused the enormous acute respiratory distress syndrome and destruction of lung tissue and a cascade towards death.
Right. And that happens in a lot of illnesses, and it's really about immune balance.
Mm-hmm.
So just saying, okay, we're going to go all out and do things that build up your immunity, I think timing is very important,
mm-hmm.
in this. So for preventive purposes or during the early phases of infection, immune boosting therapies, including mushrooms and there are a number of prebiotics that boost immunity.
Beta-glucans products.
Beta-glucans and all. I think they have value. However, if you've been sick for 5 days and you're not getting better, it's probably a good idea to stop those.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there is this what the British have identified are kind of are two phases to the illness. Phase one is a kind of gradual onset of fatigue, muscle aches, sore throat, with or without a fever. You don't need a fever to be ill with COVID-19. In China, about half of the people presenting to the hospital did not have a fever.
So that little thermometer they held to my forehead at the airport, that was just like kind of for good luck.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you have a fever, yeah, that maybe that is meaningful. But if you don't, it's not.
Yeah.
And even the people that were sick with pneumonia throughout their hospital stay, almost 20% never had a fever. So, but those are the early stage fevers. Some people will get GI infections, and it appears as if the people who have, or GI symptoms, like diarrhea, COVID-19 does infect the GI tract, and the ACE2 molecule is in the GI tract. So people who have GI symptoms as part of this actually have a worse prognosis. And again, that's the data from China. So then, at the end of 5 days, which is how long this phase one lasts, roughly, 80% of people will get better. And they may still be infectious for 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, but they'll spontaneously get better, and that'll be the end of illness for them. For the other 20%, they're going to go downhill after that, after phase one. They're going to develop pneumonia. They're going to enter into what I call phase two. And 5% of them will require, a quarter of those of them are going to require intensive care or critical care. The other 75% are going to get pretty sick. There are possibly treatments that can be implemented at that stage, although they're hard to get these days, and we can talk about that. But I don't know of any natural products that are necessarily going to work.
A possibility of intravenous vitamin C. It's shown some efficacy in sepsis, and there are some actual trials. I don't know how formal they are ongoing in China, where they're using high-dose intravenous vitamin C for the sickest patients.
Sure. These are all things that are going to happen in a hospital.
It's not like, you know, come to the office and get your IV vitamin C at that point.
Right.
You know, you're pretty infectious, and, you know, you would be doing everybody else a disservice. All right, a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts. There's lots more in this podcast about practical suggestions for things that you can do to safeguard yourself, or at the very least minimize your risk if you should be exposed to or come down with COVID-19. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, our guest, Dr. Leo Galland, and we'll be right back with part two of today's discussion about coronavirus.